Greetings, this is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, December 12th, 2025. We'll begin with a front page story, Spirit of the Season. It's a large picture, and it says, Inside Today, our biggest guide to giving yet, featuring 187 nonprofits from across the area. And it's two ladies out ringing bells for the Salvation Army. The next front page story is Illinois Legislature. New state laws take aim at gun safety. They focus on reporting stolen firearms, tracing illegal weapons. Story by Luke Taylor, out of Urbana. Two new state laws set to take effect in the new year target two areas that have frequently made local headlines: gun owners not safely storing their weapons and law enforcement's ability to track illegal firearms. House Bill 1373 amended a section of the Illinois Criminal Code regarding firearm evidence. It requires law enforcement agencies to use the National Tracing Center of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives e-Trace platform to track firearms connected to crimes. That includes any firearm that was unlawfully possessed, used for any unlawful purpose, recovered from the scene of a crime, or reasonably believed to have been used or associated with the commission of a crime, according to the new language added to the criminal code. Urbana Police Chief Larry D. Boone said this bill aligns with his efforts and goals both in Urbana and at his previous post in Norfolk, Virginia. Specifically, he highlighted a focus on data-driven firearm tracking, community-focused prevention, and a guardian-style approach to policing. Champaign County Sheriff Dustin Howerman said his office participates not only in eTrace, but also the National Integrated Ballistic Information Network, another ATF database. He said it's important for people to report guns stolen and do so quickly so that law enforcement can know to track them. I kind of put it in the same lines as somebody who leaves their car unlocked with a firearm in there, Howerman said. There's got to be some personal responsibility if you own a firearm. Senate Bill 1008, which was signed in at the same time as the House bill, addresses reporting stolen firearms as correlated to improving safe gun storage requirements. Under the new deadline, firearm owners are required to report lost or stolen guns within 48 hours of discovery of the loss or theft. The prior timeline was 72 hours. Reports must include the date of the loss or theft, the exact last known location of the firearm, a description of the circumstances of the loss or theft, and the firearm owner identification card number of the reporting person, as well as the caliber, make, model, and serial number of the firearm. If a firearm is reported stolen right away, we can enter that serial number in our system, and then if a law enforcement officer comes in contact with that firearm, they'll know it's stolen, Howerman said. If that's not reported as stolen, then we may come across a firearm and we may not even know. Even when information is reported as it should be, Howerman said it's challenging tracing guns back to their origins. That's not to mention situations like where individuals report firearms stolen when they really sold them to another individual or other similar misleading reports. Investigators put a lot of work into trying to trace where that firearm went, he said. If ballistics data were available, that improves odds of tracing weapons, Howerman said, as that will help investigators determine if the same firearm was used in more than one crime. If that gun was used in another crime, and there was firearm evidence like a bullet was retrieved or something, then we can compare them to see if it was used in that incident too, he said. The next front page story is Around the Area. Project Success of Vermilion County. Memorial Tree to Honor Victims of Gun Violence in Danville. Story by Jennifer Bailey, out of Danville. This time of year is extra hard for Phil Davis, whose daughter, 18-year-old Anaya, was fatally shot in June at a large gathering in Danville's Winter Park. The holiday sucks without her, he said, but he's doing all he can to keep her name alive, and it's motivating to seek justice for her killing, where no arrests have yet been made. As part of that effort, he helped plan a candlelight vigil and memorial tree event for victims of gun violence. The event, hosted by Project Success Youth Council Peace Ambassadors, is set for 5:30 p.m. Monday at the Douglas Discovery Garden on Florida Street, across from Douglas Park. Hopefully we can actually get the community to be more of a community, he added. Small steps, big steps. Anaya's name is among 109 that Project Success compiled of people killed by gun violence in Danville over the past 50 years. Their families, along with youth council members, local community members, and supporters of gun violence prevention, are expected to attend the event. It's a tribute to in remembrance of the lives lost to gun violence, said Namie Neitlinger, Violence Prevention Family Outreach Coordinator for Project Success. Each name and photo on the tree honors an individual whose life was tragically cut short. The Youth Council Peace Ambassadors are community leaders between 7th grade and age 22 who are committed to advocacy, leadership, and promoting peace. They wanted to host the memorial during the holiday season as a way to honor and remember those affected by gun violence. The event also provides an opportunity for the community to reflect and raise awareness, Neitlinger said. The Peace Ambassadors have been organizing events, leading projects, and providing youth perspectives on issues such as gun violence prevention. The students chose the Memorial Tree Project to honor and remember lives lost. The tree symbolizes remembrance, life, and hope, the group said. Douglas Discovery Garden was selected because it was available, and the students were given permission to use the space, Neitlinger said. They have collected around 50 photos to display on the tree. The list includes all names and dates of passing, ensuring each individual is honored even if a photo is not available, she added. The next story is in national and world news. U.S. government, no deal on ACA tax credits. Millions of Americans will face insurance premium increases January 1st. Out of Washington and the AP. The Senate on Thursday rejected legislation to extend Affordable Care Act tax credits, essentially guaranteeing that millions of Americans will see a steep rise in costs at the beginning of the year. As Republicans and Democrats have failed to find compromise, senators voted on two partisan bills instead that they knew would fail: the Democratic bill to extend the subsidies and a Republican alternative that would have created new health savings accounts. It was an unceremonious end to a months-long effort by Democrats to prevent the COVID-19-era subsidies from expiring on January 1st, including a 43-day government shutdown that they forced over the issue. Ahead of the votes, Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer of New York warned Republicans that if they did not vote to extend the tax credits, there won't be another chance to act before premiums rise for many people who buy insurance off the ACA marketplaces. Let's avert a disaster, Schumer said. The American people are watching. Republicans and Democrats never engage in meaningful or high-level negotiations on a solution, even after a small group of centrist Democrats struck a deal with Republicans last month to end the shutdown in exchange for a vote. Most Democratic lawmakers opposed the move, as many Republicans made clear that they wanted the tax credits to expire. The deal raised hopes for a compromise on health care, but that quickly faded with a lack of any real bipartisan talks. We failed, said Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski, one of four Republicans who voted for the Democratic bill, after the vote. We've got to do better. We can't just say happy holidays, brace for next year. A GOP alternative. The dueling Senate votes were the latest political messaging exercise in a Congress that has operated almost entirely on partisan terms, as Republicans pushed through a massive tax and spending cuts bill this summer, using budget maneuvers that eliminated the need for Democratic votes. In September, Republicans tweaked Senate rules to push past a Democratic blockade of all of Trump's nominees. On health care, Republicans similarly negotiated among themselves, without Democrats. The health savings accounts in the GOP bill that they eventually settled on would give money directly to consumers instead of to insurance companies, an idea that has been echoed by President Donald Trump. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, said ahead of the vote that the Democrats' simple extension of the subsidies is an attempt to disguise the real impact of Obamacare's spiraling health care costs. But Democrats immediately rejected the GOP plan, saying that the accounts wouldn't be enough to cover costs for most consumers. The Senate voted 51-48 not to move forward on the Democratic bill, with four Republicans, Maine Senator Susan Collins, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, and Alaska Senators Murkowski and Dan Sullivan, voting with Democrats. The legislation needed 60 votes to proceed, as did the Republican bill, which was also blocked in a 51-48 vote. An intractable issue. The votes were the latest failed salvo in the debate over the Affordable Care Act, former President Barack Obama's signature law that Democrats passed along party lines in 2010 to expand access to insurance coverage. Republicans have tried unsuccessfully since then to repeal or overhaul the law, arguing that health care is still too expensive. But they have struggled to find an alternative. In the meantime, Democrats have made the policy a central political issue in several elections, betting that the millions of people who buy health care on the government marketplaces want to keep their coverage. When people's monthly payments spike next year, they'll know it was Republicans that made it happen, Schumer said in November, while making clear that Democrats would not seek a compromise. Even if they view it as a political win, the failed votes are a loss for Democrats who demanded an extension of the benefits during the shutdown, and for the millions of people facing premium increases on January 1st. Maine Senator Angus King, an independent who caucuses with Democrats, said the group tried to negotiate with Republicans after the shutdown ended. But, he said, the talks became unproductive when Republicans demanded language adding new limits for abortion coverage that were a red line for Democrats. He said Republicans were going to own these increases. House to try again. Republicans have used the looming expiration of the subsidies to renew their long-standing criticisms of the ACA, also called Obamacare, and to try once more to agree on what should be done. In the House, Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, has promised to vote next week on some type of health care legislation. Republicans weighed different options in a conference meeting on Wednesday with no apparent consensus. Murkowski and other Senate Republicans who want to extend the subsidies expressed hope that the House could find a way to do it. GOP leaders were considering bills that would not extend the tax credits, but some Republicans have launched long-shot efforts to try to go around Johnson and force a vote. Hopefully some ideas emerge before the new year, said Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who has been pushing his colleagues for a short-term extension. Real Americans are paying the price for this body not working together in the way it should, said Alabama Senator Katie Britt, a Republican. Next in national and world news, Charlie Kirk's death, alleged shooter, appears in court. Defense trying to limit media access to trial. In Provo, Utah, on the AP. The Utah man charged with killing Charlie Kirk made his first in-person court appearance Thursday as his attorneys pushed to further limit media access in the high-profile criminal case. Prosecutors have charged Tyler Robinson with aggravated murder in the September 10 shooting of the conservative activist on the Utah Valley University campus in Orem, just a few miles north of the Provo courthouse. They plan to seek the death penalty. Robinson, 22, arrived amid heavy security, shackled at the waist, wrists, and ankles, and wearing a dress shirt, tie, and slacks. He smiled at his parents and brother sitting in the front row. His mother teared up after he walked in and clutched a tissue throughout the hearing while his father took notes. Robinson had previously appeared before the court via video or audio feed from jail. Early in the proceedings, State District Court Judge Tony Graff briefly stopped a media live stream of the hearing and ordered the camera be moved after Robinson's attorney said the stream showed the defendant's shackles in violation of a courtroom order. Graff said he would terminate future broadcasts if there were further violations of the order issued in October, which bars media from showing images of Robinson in restraints or anywhere in the courtroom except sitting at the defense table. "This court takes this very seriously," Graff said. "While the court believes in openness and transparency, it needs to be balanced with the constitutional rights of all parties in this case." The warning comes as Graff has been weighing the public's right to know details about the case against concerns by Robinson's attorney that the swarm of media attention could interfere with a fair trial. Robinson's legal team and the Utah County Sheriff's Office have asked to ban cameras in the courtroom, but Graf has not yet ruled on the request. Coalitions of national and local news organizations, including the Associated Press, are fighting to preserve media access in the case. Graf held a closed hearing on October 24, in which attorneys discussed Robinson's courtroom attire and security protocols. Under a subsequent ruling by the judge, Robinson is allowed to wear street clothes during pretrial hearings, but must be physically restrained due to security concerns. Graf also prohibited filming or photographing Robinson's restraints after his attorneys argued widespread images of him shackled and in jail clothing could prejudice potential jurors. Media attorney David Raymond urged Graf on Thursday to let the news organizations weigh in on any future requests for closed hearings or other limitations. He said media organizations want limited party status in the case. Stacy Visser, one of Robinson's lawyers, pushed back, "We don't want the chaos that is out in the media in this courtroom." The next in national and world news, severe weather. Tens of thousands ordered to flee northwest flooding. Out of Mount Vernon, Washington, in the AP, surging floodwaters turned farmland into vast pools, washed out bridges, and stranded people Thursday, with evacuation orders issued for tens of thousands of Washington state residents, and authorities hoping levees prevent far worse damage. "The flooding levels we're looking at are potentially historic in nature, so we just want to emphasize how serious the situation is," Governor Bob Ferguson said at a news briefing Thursday, one day after declaring a statewide emergency. About 78,000 residents of a major agricultural region north of Seattle were ordered to evacuate the Skagit River's floodplain, officials said. Along the river in Mount Vernon, teams knocked on doors in low-lying areas Thursday to inform them of evacuation notices, city authorities said. Further north near the U.S.-Canada border, Sumas, Nooksack, and Everson were evacuated after being inundated by floodwaters, while the border crossing at Sumas was closed, according to Whatcom County. Sumas Mayor Bruce Bosch said much of the city had been devastated by the high waters just 4 years after a similar flood. "I am deeply sorry that our community is facing this hardship again, but I am relieved that most students evacuated when advised," he said in an online statement. Over 10,000 customers in Washington were without electricity late Thursday afternoon, according to PowerOutage.us. Dozens of roads were inundated or washed out across the state, some of which had no detour or estimated time for reopening. A mountainous section of US 2 was closed due to rocks, trees, and mud, while a large section of state road Route 410 was closed because of water covering the roadway, according to the State Transportation Department. Heavy rain and flooding washed out at least three bridges in the mountains of northwestern Montana, where an emergency shelter opened in a church in the small town of Libby. The next story is Capitol coverage. Senator Emil Jones III bribery trial. Case closed. January retrial canceled in deferred prosecution agreement that would see charges dropped in a year. Story by Hannah Meisel, out of Chicago. State Senator Emil Jones III, Democrat of Chicago, has agreed to a deal with federal prosecutors that would avoid a retrial and see the three charges against him, including bribery, wire fraud, and lying to the FBI, dropped a year from now. Jones's deferred prosecution agreement, revealed during a Thursday court hearing, requires him to pay a $6,800 fine and admit to making false statements to FBI agents during a surprise 2019 interview at his home. The senator, who served 16 years in Springfield since replacing his father, former Illinois Senate President Emil Jones Jr., was accused of agreeing to take bribes from red light camera entrepreneur turned government operator Omar Mani in 2019. In exchange, the feds alleged Jones held back legislation he'd introduced that was harmful to the red light camera industry. But only one of the alleged bribes, a job for Jones's former intern, ever came to fruition, and the senator's high-stakes turn on the witness stand complicated prosecutors' narratives that his red light camera bill didn't pass because of Mani's offer. After nearly 23 hours of deliberation at the end of Jones's April trial, a jury deadlocked, and the U.S. District Judge Andrea Wood declared a mistrial. In June, prosecutors said they intended to try Jones' case again, including a few additional witnesses, according to Assistant U.S. Attorney Prashant Kaluri. But the deferred prosecution agreement means Jones' retrial, scheduled for January 12th, will be canceled. Jones, who testified during the trial that he'd never had an opponent to run against since he replaced his father on the ballot of in 2008, is now facing challenges from two Democrats in Illinois' March 17th primary. On Thursday, Jones told Capital News Illinois that he wished the deferred prosecution agreement could have been executed earlier this year, but was glad to put the case behind him. "Just happy I'm able to move on, have a fair election," he said. "Looking forward to getting back to serving the people, sitting on some committees, passing some bills that'll benefit my district." Jones was removed from Senate leadership after his 2022 indictment, but said it was too soon to have conversations about being reinstated. He won re-election 6 weeks after being charged, running unopposed. Alleged bribes. Jones's trial pulled back the curtain on a wider probe the feds had focused on the senator's longtime colleague, State Senator Martin Sandoval, Democrat of Chicago. Mani, the FBI mole, had also bribed Sandoval, and in June 2019, Sandoval invited Jones to dinner with him and Mani at a suburban steakhouse, during which Sandoval hinted at benefits he received from Mani. On secretly recorded video captured by Mani at the dinner, Sandoval told Jones that Mani wants to be your friend. Over another two dinners that summer, Mani offered a campaign contribution to the senator in the same conversation he asked about Jones's willingness to drop or modify legislation that called for a statewide study of red light camera systems in Illinois. Mani testified he worried a study would be a prelude to a ban on his industry. But Jones was more interested in Mani hiring his former intern, Christopher Katz. "If you can raise me $5,000, that'd be good," Jones said on a secret video recording of his dinner with Mani on July 17, 2019, after Mani pushed him to come up with a number for the proposed campaign donation. "But most importantly, I have an intern working in my office, and I'm trying to find him another job, another part-time job while he's in school. Do you all have any positions available?" Mani would eventually hire Katz directly, telling Jones later in the summer they didn't have much work for him to do at the time. "I just wanted to make sure that he's the type of kid that, you know, when he gets a check and he's not doing anything right away, that he's, you know, he's not going to be spooked by that," Mani said in an August 12, 2019 wiretapped call. "He's not going to be weird and stuff. Is he, would he be cool with that for a while? I mean, does he get it? Does he understand this?" "Yeah, but make sure to find him some work," Jones replied. Though he didn't produce any work product, Katz ended up receiving a total of $1,800 in weekly payments from Mani over the course of 6 weeks until the Fed's investigation, and Mani's role in it, was made public on September 24, 2019. On that same day, FBI agents raided Sandoval's offices and home. Before his death in late 2020, Sandoval pleaded guilty to bribery and tax fraud and was cooperating with the government. But in the hours before the public raids, a pair of agents came knocking at Jones's front door to ask about both Sandoval and Mani. Jones denied having discussed with Mani how a campaign contribution could be made without having it publicly reported, though another secretly recorded video played during trial showed Mani asking Jones how he could contribute to the senator's campaign without having it reported on public campaign finance records. During an August 2019 dinner between Jones and Mani, the senator again turned the conversation from a campaign contribution to a job for Katz. Mani never wrote a check to Jones for $5,000 or otherwise. Jones also made the risky decision to testify in his own defense. The senator told the jury that he was trying to avoid taking money from Mani, saying he gave off the vibe of a used car salesman and that he was aware Mani was trying to bribe him. But he also contradicted testimony from Katz, who downplayed his relationship with the senator, while Jones said they were close. During his surprise interview with the FBI, Jones also denied knowing that Katz was getting paid, despite he and Mani agreeing that $15 an hour was fair during their last dinner 6 weeks prior. other hung juries. Jones's mistrial was the third high-profile federal public corruption trial in 7 months to end in a hung jury. In February, jurors in former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan's case deadlocked on 6 of the 23 counts while convicting him on 10 and acquitting on 7. And on September 2024, a judge had to declare a mistrial after jurors deadlocked on all 5 counts alleging former AT&T Illinois President Paul LaChiazza bribed Madigan in 2017. LaChiazza also entered into a deferred prosecution agreement with the feds earlier this fall, avoiding a retrial that had also been scheduled for January. Capital News Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. Next story is Operation Midway Blitz. Appeals court blocks release of hundreds of detainees. By Jason Meissner of the Chicago Tribune, TNS. Out of Chicago. A federal appeals court in Chicago issued a mixed opinion Thursday in a high-profile immigration case, blocking the immediate release of hundreds of people detained during Operation Midway Blitz, but allowing the extension of a consent decree governing so-called warrantless arrests. The 2-1 split opinion from the 7th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Cummings overstepped his authority in ordering the release of people arrested with I-200 warrants that agents filled out in the field. The appeals court said Cummings had also erred in issuing a blanket order granting bond to other detainees who'd been arrested without judicially approved warrants, saying that each individual needed to be assessed for potential danger to the community. After all, this is not the bargain the defendants agreed to, and that a consent decree carefully maps out what the district judge can or cannot order, balancing defendants' immigration enforcement responsibilities and the need to maintain public safety, the majority opinion stated. The appellate ruling did, however, find that the Department of Justice, under President Donald Trump, had improperly categorized all immigration arrestees as subject to mandatory detention, regardless of their individual characteristics or lack of a criminal background. And in upholding the extension of the consent decree until February, the majority opinion said Cummings cited multiple instances where immigration officials had failed to comply with the consent decree while making warrantless arrests, and also relied on the unilateral proclamation by a DHS senior official that DHS would no longer comply with the consent decree, according to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Accordingly, we cannot say that the district court abused its discretion when finding that defendants' substantial noncompliance with a consent decree constituted a significant change in circumstances that warranted a modification, the majority opinion stated. The appeals court agreed to stay its order on the consent decree extension to allow the administration of President Donald Trump to file an emergency appeal with the Supreme Court. The third member of the panel, Judge Thomas Kirch II, dissented, saying Cummings went well beyond his authority in his release order and in extending the consent decree, which he said essentially dictates how the executive branch should enforce the nation's immigration laws. It was wrong about how much flexibility the executive branch is due when it gives up enforcement authority to the judiciary, Kirsch wrote. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of your News Gazette, dated Friday, December 12th, 2025. Please stay tuned.